Most of us have probably had the experience of asking somebody what they really thought about something. And that can be a dangerous question, particularly if you're asking people who are known to tell the truth. Does this dress make me look fat? Do these pants seem to emphasize my belly? You may not like the answer that you get. When we were first married, I would ask Debbie almost every Sunday, "So what'd you think of the sermons?" And I stopped doing that. In the very beginning, because she was so enamored with me in general, she would always say, "Oh, I thought they were really good." But as she became more skilled in her analysis, that's a tactful way of saying this, she became more skilled in her analysis, she would from time to time say, "Well, you know, you didn't get off to a very good start. But strong finish, strong finish." And after a while, I just stopped asking. Because while she wasn't being unkind or even hypercritical, she was painfully honest at times. And sometimes I didn't get what I was really looking for. I probably got what I needed, but not what I would have preferred. Just received an email this week from a friend inviting me to participate in an email game. Here's how the game goes. You send emails out to a lot of your friends, and what they're supposed to do is respond with one word. One word that they think about when they think of you. And he wants me to send an email back with one word describing him. Folks, that's risky. Because you don't know how honest people may be. That may not turn out to be a real fun game. Haven't decided if I'm going to play or not. Because part of the game is then you do the same thing to a lot of your friends and they respond. I don't know if I want to go there, to be honest with you. And all of this, of course, suggests that there are just some things that we think that we do not reveal to others. And I don't mean necessarily that we mean to be unkind, but sometimes our assessments of things are just pretty frank, pretty blunt, pretty honest, particularly if we're Christians, should be that way. I wonder how our relationships with our friends would fare if all of our thoughts were transparent for everyone to see. I really suspect, and I say this not meaning to be pessimistic or certainly not intending to encourage dissembling one with another. But I got to be honest, I think sometimes our friendships thrive because we don't know what other people are thinking. In general, they may think very good things about us, but every once in a while, God, Alan, man, that was a bomb this morning. I don't even want to know if you're thinking that. Just shake my hand, say another good effort, and we'll go on from there. But here's what we do need to remember. And that is that God knows all of our thoughts. And it's very easy, as we have this ability to conceal sometimes, well, anytime we wish pretty much, what we're thinking, it's easy to believe that such is the case with God also. That we can conceal what we're thinking, the content of our thoughts, from our Creator. But this fact that God knows the thoughts and the intents of our heart formed part of the advice that David gave to Solomon as he gave him advice about how to rule as a successful king and, in a more broader sense, how to live his life. The passage that I wanted to talk about this evening, the verse, is 1 Chronicles 28 and verse 9. I got kidded a little bit this morning about how I was going to take David's instructions to Solomon that he was supposed to wipe out David's enemies and make that apply to our lives. You can go wherever you want with that, but that's not the passage I have in mind. 1 Chronicles 28, though, is very applicable, very practical for us. It reads as follows, "As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father and serve him with a loyal heart and with a willing mind, for the Lord searches all hearts and understands all the intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. In the context of 1 Chronicles 28, it is near the end of David's reign, and he is explaining to the people of Israel that it will be Solomon among all of David's sons. It will be Solomon who will build the house of the Lord and who will rule in his stead. Solomon, incidentally, was not the oldest son, might not have been the most likely candidate had the people been choosing a king, but he was the one that the Lord had chosen to succeed David on the throne. And so, at the very end of David's life, nearly, he gives advice to Solomon on this occasion on how to be a successful king. I can relate very well to what David probably felt on that occasion. And some of the rest of you whose children have already left home probably likewise can understand the feeling of a parent who realizes that the time for giving instruction, that the opportunities to pass along good advice are rapidly passing. And so you want to give them the best advice. You want to give them the most fundamental, most helpful advice that you possibly can. I felt that way about both of my sons as they left home, formed their own families, got married, and now living their own lives. It's more difficult for me now to talk to them and preach to them, in a sense, as a parent, because they're adults and they need to run their own lives. Give advice when it's asked for. And from time to time I offer advice, but I have to be more cautious now. You want to give your children the best advice at the last minute that will stand them in good stead. And that's, of course, what David is trying to do. And we're going to look at that advice. I've used the word admonition on my slides. I changed it in my outline to exhortation. It's not entirely a warning. It is more an encouragement, which is the concept behind exhortation. Exhortation is essentially encouragement or an urging to do something. And David is going to urge Solomon, to encourage him to do several things. And I'd like to apply those exhortations, or that exhortation, to our own service to God. And so, without further delay, let's get started looking at this verse once again, the individual pieces of it. David begins, "As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father." And that may seem like kind of a strange thing to say. Would Solomon, could he possibly forget who God was, or would he be unaware of the God that his father David had worshipped? I think we need to understand that the word "know" here is used in a little different sense, or with a little different connotation than that idea or that meaning. In the New International Version, the word here is acknowledge. And that really broadens the concept, doesn't it, for us? It seems to me more than just the recognition that God exists. Don't forget, Solomon, that Jehovah God is a living God, that He's a real God, as opposed to the false gods who do not exist. But instead, the idea is more comprehensive. It is that you acknowledge God as Lord, as Master. Now, some part of the matter is that in Israel's history, frequently Israel forgot who God was. There's a statement made in Judges, the second chapter, that in a sense kind of sets the scene for the entire historical record of Judges. And it has to do with the generation that lived after Moses' generation and Joshua's generation. It was the next generation, the generation that hadn't seen all the spectacular things that God had done in terms of bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt, the parting of the sea, and the 40 years of manna every morning, 6 days a week, that is. Another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which He had done for Israel. And I think it's being said here, not so much that they were totally unaware of what God had done or of His existence, but more along the lines that they didn't acknowledge Him. In 1 Samuel, the second chapter, I think a similar thing is being said about the sons of Eli, who were serving, incidentally, in the tabernacle, and yet the record says they didn't know the Lord. Even the prophet Hosea, as he preaches to the northern kingdom, made the observation that in general, in the land, there wasn't any truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. In chapter 5 and verse 4, they do not direct their deeds toward turning to their God, for the spirit of harlotry is in their midst, and they do not know the Lord. Likewise, in chapter 8 and verse 2, while they may have claimed to know the Lord, the fact of the matter is, they did not really acknowledge Him as God intended to be acknowledged. To know God seems to imply not just knowledge about God, but also having a good relationship with Him. And the idea may even be further than that, and that is that it is to hear God or to pay attention to Him. Now, David continues talking to Solomon by saying, in addition to knowing the God of your father, he says, and serve Him with a loyal heart and with a willing mind. The word loyal here is an interesting word because according to Wilson's Old Testament word studies, it really means a whole heart or a perfect heart, an undivided heart. In fact, that's the way the King James Version translates that verse. And serve Him with a perfect heart. Not in the sense of without flaw, but a complete or whole heart. That Solomon's affections were not to be divided with one God and some of his attention, some of his allegiance to another God. And so the idea is not so much sincerity as it is undivided affections. Jesus made the observation in the New Testament that the man who serves two masters has divided affections and cannot serve either with a whole heart. What Jesus says in Matthew the 6th chapter, verse 24, and we'll look at it a little bit later on, is that He'll serve one or the other, but He really can't serve two masters well. And what David is telling Solomon is that he needs to serve God with an undivided heart. And what we learn is that Solomon did not do that. I find it rather interesting, and perhaps you will also, in 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, the text in the Old Testament that records Solomon's fall, his unfaithfulness to God and his engaging in idolatry. But listen to the words of 1 Kings, the 11th chapter and verse 4. 1 Kings 11, verse 4, "For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord, his God, as was the heart of his father David." I am persuaded that Solomon probably never stopped worshiping Jehovah God, at least to some extent. But what he did was he added idolatry into his life, and his heart becomes divided in his allegiance to various gods. Now, David told Solomon that he was not only to serve God with a loyal heart, but also with a willing mind, as opposed to grudging compliance to the various statutes and commandments of God. And David continues by noting the reason for this advice. Inside of every one of us, if you'll follow the figure with me, is a closed door. It is locked from the inside, suggesting that we're the only ones, at least in a sense, who can open that door or allow it to be opened for others to see inside. People around us, our friends, our acquaintances, even those whom we really don't know very well, they only get a glimpse behind this door when we purposefully or sometimes inadvertently open the door for them. We reveal our thoughts. We reveal the thinking of our heart purposefully and sometimes without intent, but we have to do the revealing. The truth of the matter is that this door is the door to our mind and it controls access to our thoughts. And I can keep you out. In fact, some people can become very adept at playing the double game. They present one thing when in fact their thoughts are something very different. But they can do it because they keep the door shut. They're very cautious about what they let people see. And you can't force your way in. The door's locked. I don't want to tell you who has the master key. And that's the Lord. And that's David's point to Solomon. He says, "For the Lord searches all hearts and understands all the intent of the thoughts." David understood that very well. In his youth, he was selected king out of several of brothers of Jesse, eight. He was the youngest. And when Samuel came to anoint the king who would succeed Saul because of the Lord's displeasure with Saul, when Eliab the oldest came, Samuel thought, "This is the one. This has got to be the one." Eliab may have been impressive outwardly, but the Lord made the observation to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I've refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And the Lord had looked at Eliab and said, 'Not him. He won't work.'" The Lord was able to look right into this man's heart and know that he wouldn't be a suitable king. And the one that nobody really probably would have picked, the youngest son, the one incidentally was out with the flocks, they had to go fetch him. The Lord had already looked into his heart. And while he wasn't an unpleasant looking young man, more important was the condition, the quality of his heart. In 1 Kings, the 8th chapter, in verse 39, later on at the dedication of the temple, Solomon would again reiterate this very point. As he prays to God, he says, "Then hear in heaven your dwelling place, and forgive and act, and give to everyone according to all his ways, whose heart you know. For you alone know the hearts of all the sons of men." The law provided, the law of Moses provided for judgment, provided for justice. But like all laws that are administered by men, sometimes justice is not done. Naboth died because people lied about what he'd done. He was an innocent man who was judged by the law. Because sometimes people don't understand what the truth is. And that's true about people's hearts. Solomon is talking about that very thing. And what he's praying to God in the context, what he's praying about is, "Lord, we may not exercise your law perfectly, but you know the hearts of men. And you," he asks, "take care of that. Make sure that the righteous is rewarded and the unjust is punished." Jeremiah, the prophet, likewise spoke of this point in a couple of passages that are very similar. He made the observation that the Lord judges righteously, testing the mind and the heart. One of the reasons that sometimes we don't judge very righteously is because we don't really know a person's heart entirely. It's that door thing until they open the door. And even then sometimes we don't understand very perfectly what really lies within. But the Lord does. And when He makes His judgments, they are accurate. Pinpoint accuracy. He knows exactly in every nook and cranny of our minds, if you'll follow the figure, what we are thinking and the intents of our heart. "But O Lord of hosts, you who test the righteous and see the mind and heart, let me see your vengeance on them, for I have pleaded my cause before you." Lord, you know what they're like. You know their hearts. Now the advice that David offered Solomon is excellent advice for a young man who's ascending to the throne of God's people. Just out of curiosity, anybody here tonight feel like they may be in line for like some sort of kingship or... Nobody? Does that mean that we can just take this stuff and say, "Well, that was good for Solomon"? Or is it the case that this advice really is good for all people, including us, even if we're not in line for the throne of any country? We also must know the Lord if we're going to be successful in this life. Note some passages that John, the Apostle John, wrote in his first general epistle. In chapter 2 of 1 John, beginning in verse 3, here's what he writes. He says, "Now by this we know that we know Him, if we keep His commandments. He who says, 'I know Him,' and does not keep His commandments is a liar. The truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. John, again, is using the word know in a special sense. He's not just talking about the recognition that God exists or the recognition even of what God has said. But you don't know God until you're keeping his commandments. That's the implication of John's writing here. In the third chapter, in verse 1, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called children of God. Therefore, the world doesn't know us because it did not know him. We don't have a relationship with these people because they don't have a relationship with God. In verse 6 of the same chapter, whoever abides in him does not sin. Whoever sins has neither seen him nor known him. There's a lot more that could be said about this passage. Sins here, or the phrase does not sin, is talking about this business, as we talked about this morning in Ephesians 2, the idea of walking in sin, continuing in sin, living a life of sin. John's not talking about the occasional sin of the Christian. He's saying people who know God, those who keep his commandments, don't sin. They don't live this life of continuous, unabated and unrepented of sin. In the second place, we also must serve the Lord willingly and with a whole or a loyal heart. I still remember a Wednesday night invitation that Steve Williams gave, it's been a couple years ago, talking about the prophet Elijah. And he did such a wonderful job of telling the story of Elijah and the competition between the prophet Elijah and all the prophets of Baal on the other side. But you may recall something that Elijah said to the nation of Israel. He said, how long will you sit between two opinions, falter between, make up your mind. Who will you serve? Will it be Baal or will it be Jehovah? But staying in the middle, you can't do that. Israel couldn't make up their mind. They would vacillate back and forth and frequently try to serve both Jehovah God and false gods. Even as today, Christians sometimes do the very same thing. We try to serve God at the same time that we're trying to fit in with the world. You can't do it. You just can't do it. Jesus made the observation in Matthew, the 6th chapter, in verse 24, no one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal, isn't that interesting? Loyal to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God and mammon. Now, Jesus is suggesting that it's impossible to serve successfully two masters because the whole concept of serving a master demands everything you are. No master wants to share. And certainly God doesn't. And we need to be aware of that when we're tempted to divide our loyalties. What God is demanding from us is commitment. He demands our whole heart, total surrender. I made the observation recently that I don't spend a lot of time preaching about attendance. And maybe that's a weakness in the way that I talk, but I'll tell you the thinking behind that is when people want to be here, they will be here without me having to tell them or anybody else having to tell them, you have to come here. And then the question becomes, if I tell them that they have to come here and they come out of obligation rather than desire, I have to wonder whether it really does them much good and certainly whether their worship is of any value to God. Does he care about worship that has been, in a sense, squeezed out of people who would rather be someplace else? When people have given their entire heart to God, it is no burden for them to worship God, spend time with God's people, and think about things that are spiritual, to feed upon the Word of God. That's not a problem. In fact, you don't have to spend a lot of time encouraging them to give when they've already given their heart. Their money goes where their heart is. And so does their time, and so do their energies. Now I understand, please don't misunderstand me, I understand we need to teach responsibilities, and we have responsibilities, we need to be clear about what those are. But at the same time, really it's a heart problem when people are not doing what they ought to do and they are aware of their responsibilities. What the Lord wants is our whole heart. Interesting statement about Amaziah. one of the kings in the southern kingdom. Amaziah was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Joadan of Jerusalem, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Boy, that's great. There you go. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord. That's not the end of the verse. It keeps going. But not with a loyal heart. Is God really just interested about in how many bodies manage to make it to the building? Is He just interested in us enduring for a certain amount of time, a reasonable period of time, on Sunday a couple times and on Wednesday midweek? Or does He really want our hearts? Loyal hearts, undivided hearts. If you were to read a little bit longer, I'm not going to do that this evening, but if you read a little bit further in 2 Chronicles chapter 25, go on down to verses 14 and following and find out the consequences of serving God, doing the right things, but with a heart that wasn't loyal. That never works. Sooner or later, one leaves the Lord. Psychologists say that the average person thinks 10,000 thoughts every day. Well, except for Mondays. On Mondays, totals are probably somewhere around 500, 600 max. And that's if you work long hours. I'm just kidding. And I don't know how you count that. If there's a little thought meter up there that they can click onto the side of your head, and every time something occurs to you, you know, a number clicks, at the end of the day, they just read it and it says 10,000. That would be interesting to figure out how they came to this conclusion. But here's my point. Let's just grant them, for the sake of argument, that 10,000 thoughts run through our minds each day. And if you don't think that many run through your mind, I wouldn't raise your hand to volunteer the information. So just go with me on this. That means that in a single year, you're dealing with 3.5 million thoughts. That's a lot of content to shepherd. That's a lot of mental activity to be cautious about. How many opportunities there are to think things that are not very pleasing to God. To think things that frankly are sinful, that we ought not to be thinking. What a task to control the content of our minds. Now I understand, and I hope you do also, that I do not believe that I can regulate with perfect security, everything that I think. There are things that pass through our minds, that flip through our minds very quickly, but I certainly can control those things that I dwell on. And if there's 10,000 running through my mind and one of them is evil, I don't want it to be doing reruns, is the point. I need to control those thoughts. And I'll tell you why. Because the Lord knows everything I think. The psalmist David said, O Lord, You've searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thoughts afar off. God has the master key. And furthermore, He's going to bring all those secret things in my life into judgment. And that's a sobering thought, if you'll pardon the pun. God knows when we smile at our brother but hate him in our hearts. God knows when we sing with our mouths with disconnected minds, thoughts that are frankly 1,000 miles away. God knows when we sit with the saints but would rather not worship our Creator. In his old age, David gave Solomon some really good advice, and I'm passing that advice along to you. In his old age, Solomon stopped following that advice. Solomon stopped serving the Lord with a loyal heart and turned to idolatry. 1 Kings the 11th chapter says he was influenced by his foreign idolatrous wives. And I just want to make the observation that you and I need to be careful as we're trying to serve God with an undivided heart, a loyal heart. We need to be careful about who it is that's influencing us. The last thing I want to leave with you is that while others may influence us, it is in the final analysis our own decision, our responsibility as to whether we will serve God as we should or whether we'll do as Solomon did and turn away from God. Well, I thank you very much for your attention. 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 9. If you seek Him, He will be found by you. But if you forsake Him, He will cast you off forever. Actually, we have the opportunity to seek God until the Lord comes again. The invitation of the gospel is extended. Not by me, but by the Lord. And it's an ongoing invitation. The question is, are you seeking Him? Those who seek will find. Those who knock, to them it'll be opened. Do you know God? Not just do you know something about God, do you acknowledge that He exists? More than that, do you have a relationship with God? Are you in fellowship with Him? Because if you're not, then the advice that David gave to Solomon is especially relevant in your case. And we want to encourage you this evening to begin your relationship with the Lord through your obedience to the gospel, expressing your faith in Jesus as the Son of God. You can be baptized for the remission of your sins this evening. In so doing, incidentally, you acknowledge God. You acknowledge Him as your master. You submit to Him in humble obedience, which is what God asks. He wants our hearts. Will you give Him your heart this evening? If we can assist you in doing that, won't you come to the front as we stand to sing and to invite you?